title New Age Worship. I'm not sure how to title it again that way. Let's just say worship in the 90s or worship for a new day or whatever. My name is Paul Bosch, and I began last time we met, which would have been yesterday, talking about ritual and what it does for people, the difference between routine and ritual, and then five or six aspects of our wonderful tradition. And we have a tradition that we ought to honor, tradition being a way of giving your grandparents a vote in the decisions you must make today. Not the only vote, not the deciding vote, but at least a vote in the decisions that we must make today. And you don't have to be an Oedipus. Oedipus kills his father, and you don't have to kill your father in order to be mature, in order to be. But let us hope that we do grow into some kind of maturity in the Christian faith. One of the things that troubles me about some so-called contemporary worship is that I think it tends to keep us infants. It infantilizes us. And I resent that. I don't think we should be kept infants. We should be willing to stretch a little bit and grow a little bit and find, always a mystery out there. Let me lay a statistic on you and tell a story. First of all, a story. The story sounds almost too good to be true, but I was told that it was really the truth. A visitor is in a foreign country, I think it was supposed to be Latin America, did not know the language, but he had a guide with him who did know the language. And they came upon a public park in a big city, and in this public park, there's a fellow standing on a soapbox, preaching, presumably. I guess they do that at Hyde Park in London, and they do that in some other places around the world. As a matter of fact, in our little town, we have a speaker's corner, and there's a built-in podium there where anybody can make a speech in downtown Kitchener, Ontario. Anyhow, this fellow is standing on a soapbox, and he's preaching. And he's pounding his fist into his hand, and he's wagging his finger at the crowd, and he's shaking his fist at the crowd, and he's frowning at them, and he's hurling these abrasive sounds at them. And the visitor, who doesn't know the language, turns to his guide and he says, "What's this fellow preaching?" And the guide says, "Love." That just is a bizarre story to me, and as I say, almost too good to be true, because it illustrates so perfectly what I want to point out with you today, namely, that all of what we do in worship has the effect of teaching and preaching and proclaiming. Let me lay this statistic on you. I heard a statistic long ago. I've heard people since dispute how you can possibly determine this statistic or the accuracy of these statistics, but I'll bet it's pretty close to the truth. This is it. 55% of everything that you know about me when you first meet me, you perceive non-verbally. 55%, in other words, of everything when you first meet me, my clothes, how I stand, how I move, whether I smile, whether I frown, how I gesture, that kind of stuff. That's all nonverbal body language. And costume. 55%. On top of that, 38% is still not the words, but what they call vocal. In other words, my voice, whether I speak loud or soft, whether I speak fast or slow, whether I'm shouting or whispering. It's the kind of thing that you get into when you're training a dog, bad dog. And that puppy knows, that something's wrong and puts his tail under his legs and runs under the chair. He can't speak English. He could easily be Japanese or Swedish or whatever. But the dog knows from your vocal, the way you're vocalizing that something's wrong and that he's done wrong. That's vocal. 38%. 55% nonverbal body language. 38% vocal. What's left? 7%, dear friends. 7% is the meaning of the words themselves in a specific language. Now that statistic ought to give a preacher nightmares, or a teacher, or a parent. I mean, anybody who communicates ought to be aware that set of statistics is probably pretty accurate and probably pretty close to the truth. And I suppose when you know me better, then the verbal is going to increase. That percentage is going to increase a little bit, maybe increase a great deal. But the body language and the nonverbal stuff and the vocal stuff is nevertheless very, very important. And I'd like to spend some time with you this afternoon talking about those matters. Those of you who are pastors and seminarians will know this word, and maybe lay people will not. Adiaphora. It's a Latin word, and it can roughly be translated as those things that are neither commanded nor rejected in our gospel. And Lutherans are fond of saying, well, worship is a matter of adiaphora. In other words, the forms of worship are not commanded in the gospel. You can make up any forms of worship you want to because they are neither commanded nor proscripted in our gospel. Same with church order, church organization. You can have bishops or you don't have to have bishops. It doesn't make a bit of difference. The gospel does not mandate that. So adiaphora has come to mean, for Lutherans particularly, stuff that is almost of no importance. I mean, you speak to some pastors and to some Lutheran theologians even, and they try to come off as saying that matters of gesture or posture or whether you wear vestments or not or what kind of vestments or whether you have candles or not or whether you have processions, all that stuff is of secondary importance. It is not at the heart of the gospel. And I would be the first to agree with that. However, having said that, I cite the statistic that I just cited and say, nevertheless, all of that stuff teaches. All of that stuff has the ability to communicate. And we should be very conscious that it communicates and make certain that it communicates what we want to communicate. It could communicate the opposite of the words of our gospel. Like the sidewalk preacher, you know, he's pounding his fist, he's shaking his fist, he's wagging his finger. It sounds as if he's talking about the farthest thing you can think of from his topic, which is love. He's presumably talking about love, but everything in that experience, apart from the actual meaning of the words, denies the actual meaning of the words. And I think we ought to ask ourselves, therefore, in our worship, what is it that people see out there in terms of the architectural setting, in terms of the posture and position and gesture of the worship leaders, in terms of what they're wearing and so on? What is all that communicating? And is it communicating what we want it to communicate? And so a study of this kind of thing, namely the arts and worship, is not unimportant. I have spent my life in that study, and I don't make an apology for it. I mean, I find it fun and fascinating, among other things, but I also believe that it helps to communicate the gospel. If it doesn't communicate the gospel, it doesn't mean it's not communicating. It's already communicating, but it may be communicating something other than the gospel. So, the study of all of these arts in expressing and communicating what we want it to express and communicate is simply part of our homiletical or hermeneutical homework. We have homework to do in studying the scripture. Okay, we have similar homework to do in knowing something about the arts and how they communicate. And when I'm talking about the arts, I'm talking architecture or environmental setting, if you wanted to put it that way, motion or movement, gesture, action. I'm talking music. All this, you see, is pre-verbal, right? None of this stuff has words connected with it yet. I am talking words, of course. I'm talking symbols and signs. I'm talking vestments. All that stuff communicates. All that stuff expresses and communicates, and if it's not our gospel, as I say, it could be something else, and we ought to be careful about that. William Lazarus is one of our theologians. Has he ever been to Holden Village? I'll bet he has. He should be, anyhow.
Yes.
Bishop, he has been? Yeah. He's bishop, has been most recently, bishop of New York City, now retired. But he has said this. There are practical implications in our theology. And then he's a kind of a wordsmith. He loves to play with words. And he turned that phrase around. He says there are also theological implications in our practice. You see what he's saying? There are practical implications in what we believe, what we teach in our theology, how that works, how it works itself out in our worship, or in our ethics, or in whatever. But, flipping that around, there are also theological implications in our practice, how we do things. Have you ever heard lex orandi, lex credendi? It means, again, that's Latin, and it says the law of worship is the law of belief. In other words, the way people worship is the way that they believe. And it's as if people get their theology, and I think this is true, people get their theology from Sunday morning. And that includes the sermon, of course, and the scriptures that are read, and the prayers, but it includes all the other stuff, too. It includes all the nonverbals that go into making up what we do in our worship. Let's just take for a minute, this is a little kind of a footnote, but let's just take for a minute architecture. There'd be basically two ways that you could arrange architectural space for worship. One would be radial and the other would be axial. And both have a long history in Christian tradition and Christian worship, and I wouldn't say one is more correct than the other, but one preaches a slightly different sermon from the other. Radial, as you might expect, is what we've got here this afternoon in the fireside room. We're more or less in a circle, all of us looking one another in the eye. I mean, that's ideally what a radial setup is. Assuming you have a square space, you have people gathered around it. That's radial, like radius. Axial, again, if you have the same space, to organize it on an axis, and you have people lined up looking at the backs of each other's heads. Now, most churches, as you know, are built like this. But you should know that there are a lot of churches, ancient churches, that are built like this, or at least like this, half of a radius, and each of them preaches a different sermon. What would you say is the sermon preached by each? Let's begin with this one. What sermon is preached by an axial type of arrangement? Just the space. What are you doing? Go ahead. Give everybody's answer is correct.
Those up there and the ones down there.
Right, yeah. You could even make it as they did in the Middle Ages into a two-room space and have this space here devoted to clergy and this space here devoted to the lay people. I mean, you're getting some problems now. Medieval churches, as you may know, were designed like a cross from the air. If you looked at Notre Dame Cathedral, for instance, in Paris, from the air, you would see it's basically a cross. Flying buttresses and all that kind of stuff, towers on the West End and all that. But the altar was pushed against the wall. The clergy sat in choir facing each other here. And the people stood, no pews, here. And there was a fence right there. And this was the really holy space, and this space was not so holy. And in an Orthodox church, Greek or Russian Orthodox, there's a screen there, an icon screen with little doors in it, three little doors. And what goes on behind here is absolutely invisible. Except that every now and then a priest comes out and tells you what's going on behind there. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but I mean, that's how holy it is. There's a sense, in other words, that the closer you get to the east, these churches were all oriented toward the east. So they call the altar end the east end. Even if it's in the west, they still call it the east end, the architects do. And the east here, the rising sun and all that symbolism, you know, it's nice symbolism, but the idea is we're marching. We're marching toward the New Jerusalem. We're marching toward God. And the closer you get to the east, therefore, the holier it is. And by implication, the farther from the east, this would be the west end, the more secular or the more uncommitted or the more marginally committed you'd be. So it's no accident that Lutherans sit in the back of the church. What are you saying when you sit in the back of the church? You're saying, I'm not certain I want to be committed to this, right? Now, you could also say, well, if they sit out in the front, they're show-offs. And that is a possibility, but it seems to me the farther you get from the action up here, if all the action is understood to be up here, the farther you get from that action, the more minimally you are involved. With my little kids in Sunday school, I sometimes point out how if you were to make a long line as if you were a bunch of Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts going on a hike, I ask them, what would the people in the front of the line, how would their experience of the hike be different from the people at the back of the line? For instance, if it was deep snow in the wintertime and the snow was up to your hips, who would have the hardest work to do? The people in the front of the line, sure. The people in the back would have a free ride because it would be all pushed, the snow would be all trampled down. So, the people in the front of the line are probably going to have to be expected to work harder, right? On the other hand, how about in the front of the line, what if there was a deer or a bear there? Who would be the lucky ones to see it? The people in the front of the line, not the people in the back of the line. The bear would be gone, or the deer would be gone by the time they got there, right? You see the difference? So the people in the front have to work harder, and the people in the front are also rewarded. Rewarded more. So if you bring kids to church, bring them to the front row. That's my advice, quite seriously. Don't take them to the back. Put them in the front where they can see the action. Okay, that's axial, and it has this sense that we're marching to Jerusalem. That's a good image, nothing wrong with that. It gets to be a bad image, however, if we begin to think that this is a holy space and this is not a holy space, right? And it even gets worse. We're going to talk about this. Is it tomorrow? I think it is tomorrow. Entertainment evangelism, where you have the feeling these people are an audience and these people are performers. And these people are putting on a show or a performance for these people. I mean, that's dreadful. Now, in contrast, this kind of a setup, radio, gives the feeling that you're all invited on stage. You may not want to be on stage. You may want to turn in your ticket, or you may want to withdraw a little bit. But in this kind of arrangement, you can hardly escape being in somebody's view. And Christian worship ought to be, as we will discover tomorrow, a situation where everybody who walks in the door is invited to be on stage. Everybody who walks in the door is invited to be an actor. Not in the audience, but an actor, a performer. Again, you may not want to be that, but you're nevertheless invited to be. And if we once begin to think of our worship in terms of an audience and a group of performers, that's bad news. We've lost something very important. Okay, moving along. Worship and the hunger for primary experience, I'm reading from my outline here. I don't have to tell you, we live in an age of cultural inflation. Back in the old days, you went to the store and you could buy a box of, let us say, breakfast cereal or detergent for your cleaning up or whatever, and there was small and medium and large. But nowadays, it's family size, let's say, and large and gigantic. You see what I'm saying? That's cultural inflation. Furthermore, your ears are assaulted day after day by music, canned muzak, you know, in the elevators, for goodness sake, and in the supermarket, and in the dentist waiting room, and you can't escape Paco Bell's Canon or whatever. And what have we learned to do? Tune out, absolutely. We learn to tune it all out, turn it all off. We do not listen anymore. Same with this family size, large, and super giant or whatever. You know, we don't take that seriously any longer. Those words are meaningless. And we become very cynical. With good reason. I mean, it's understandable. And the result has been that living in this kind of a world where everything is hyped up and there's so much technology, my Lord, Americans and, well, Canadians too, are just infatuated with technology in ways that are not healthy, in ways that mitigate against coming face to face with what the liturgiologists that I know speak of as primary experience. And we shouldn't allow that to happen in our worship, say these people. They say we should bring people face to face with primary experience. Every little country church in our part of the world, I don't know about yours, but every little country church has to have a PA system, for crying out loud. And it's no bigger a space than this room, and still they got to have a mic and the boomers or whatever. I mean, that's technology run amok. And the result is the human voice is amplified and distorted. You've got to have a wall-to-wall carpet in every church. And what does that do? It deadens the sound. It insulates you from the sound of those heels clicking on the slate or on the stone or on the concrete or whatever. Rule Howe, any of you know Rule Howe, the miracle of dialogue? He says the sound of those feet coming down the aisle to communion, that is a sound that proclaims the gospel. And we insulate ourselves against that by carpeting. So most carpeting in most churches is a big mistake. Same with PA systems, I would say, if a church is, not just me, but I've heard a Roman Catholic architect say this, if a church is so big that it needs a PA system, it's too big. We should hear the naked human voice. You should hear those clicks of those heels coming down the aisle. Artificial flowers at the altar. Candles that are electrified that flicker, you know, they don't just burn, they actually flicker, you know, when you turn them on, my Lord. We don't need that phony stuff. The world is plastic out there, and the world is full of phony stuff like that, and I think the church, the Christian worship, ought to be a refuge from all of that stuff. I would like to see worship here done without a mic. Do you really need it? I bet you don't. Now, for speech making and putting on the tape and so on, you need this, but you certainly don't need my voice amplified in this room. I bet you wouldn't need most voices amplified in that room either. Well, that's a special kick that I'm on. In any case, we are insulating ourselves against what the theologians that I know call primary experience, the miracle of a single candle flame illuminating a dark nave. I mean, that's wonderful. The touch of a human hand on your head and blessing in the healing service, let's say. That's wonderful. People are starved. Modern people are starved for those experiences that our grandparents, again, they could take for granted. They were not surrounded with all this technology that we're surrounded with. And they could take all this primary stuff for granted, but we can't. And we have to, I think, say, well, what is possible is not necessarily desirable. You see Jurassic Park or read the book? I mean, that's one of the issues, one of the philosophical issues that that book raises. Is it simply because it's possible for us to do something? Does that mean we should do it? Well, I'm not certain. You know, I think actively there are certain things that we can do that we should not do, technically. Okay, worship and the hunger for primary experience and insulating ourselves against the authentic. That's what we're doing. We're really insulating ourselves against encounter with the authentic. And I think people are crying out for encounters with what is authentic and what is real. And the church doesn't do anybody a favor when we simply go along with the rest of the culture and succumb to all that technology that just gets in the way of primary experience. Eyes that see, ears that hear, listening to the voices. Let's talk about that for a minute. Why should it make a difference that we change, for instance, the appearance of the church in Lent and then change it again at Easter? You know, that wonderful color code that the church has developed down through the centuries. That's part of our tradition that I was talking about yesterday. Part of the tradition of the church is this wonderful set of colors that we have. The color for the season that we're in right now is? Green. Very good. What color is it in Lent?
Purple.
Very good. What color is it in Easter?
White.
Or even on Easter Day, gold. What color is it at Christmas?
White.
What color is it in Advent?
Purple or blue.
Yeah, blue or purple. We got a blue now.
In tradition.
What's that?
It depends where you are in tradition.
That's right, yeah, that's certainly true. It used to be purple, right. And I don't have a blue chasuble, I just have a purple one that I am very fond of, so I wear purple. But it could be blue these days. at Advent. Anyhow, you've got to be introduced into that scheme. You have to be initiated into it. You don't know it automatically. The colors themselves don't say that. As I understand, for instance, in Korea, white is the color of funerals. So maybe in Korea they'd have to have a different Christian color scheme too. But in the West anyhow, and in the churches that you were brought up in most likely, there is this inherited tradition of color, which I think is a terrific teaching device, a terrific opportunity to teach, and it's something you have to learn. It's something you have to be initiated into. And once you're initiated into it, then, ooh, you miss it if it's not there or if it's violated in some way. I know our church, as a matter of fact, back home, has a blue banner for Reformation Day. It has the Luther seal on it, but the background of the banner is blue. And I thought, oh dear, how unfortunate. The background of the banner should be
red.
Very good. Yeah, red is the color of Saints' Days and Pentecost and so on. Now, that's a wonderful teaching opportunity. And to see a church in Lent that's all dressed in purple and the minister in purple, no flowers on the altar, just greens. Have you observed that tradition in some of your churches? No flowers during the whole season of Lent. No flowers during Advent either. Greens may be like evergreens, but not flowers. Flowers come at Easter. Lilies, hyacinths, it means wonderful. There's a difference. You're teaching with your eye as well as with your words when you have that kind of a scheme. And I would think that a pastor and a worship committee and a congregation would want to observe that and help people to be initiated into that. My little daughter, when she was, what, 6 or 7, said, "Daddy, are you going to wear your smile today?" You know how the chasuble at the bottom has most chasubles anyhow, have a kind of a round, I would hold up my hands, and, you know, that's kind of neat, that round bottom. She thought that was a smile. That stuff does not escape children. It may escape their their elders, but it does not escape children. Children pick up those vibes very quickly, and by the time they're adults, we beat it out of them. I mean, that's a criticism of our educational system and the way we bring up kids, among other things. It should not be that way. We should not lose that wonderful childlike sensitivity. So we're missing, if we don't make use of that variety, we are missing a marvelous opportunity to teach. Who was it? Somebody wrote in a thing that I read recently about the typical non-Lutheran, non-Roman Catholic, non-Anglican Protestant church where Sunday after Sunday the minister, a male almost always in those days anyhow, would be standing at a lectern unadorned in a black robe. Advent, Christmas, Lent, Easter, doesn't matter. Unvarying throughout the year. How much more rich would be to see that sequence of colors that help to teach what the gospel is all about. Now, doesn't make a bit of difference to God, I'm sure. But it makes a difference to us. I think to have that color code, for instance, is a wonderful treasure. And it's not simply neutral. It teaches. So we want to take advantage of that teaching opportunity. We want, furthermore, to let that voice speak. We want the voice of color to have its witness. We want the voice of flowers and greens to make their witness. I think the arts, like flowers or color or fabric or whatever, want to make their witness. And if we don't utilize them, they're languishing, and they're silenced, and they're muted, and that's a pity. So that's the second good reason for this variety. And the third good reason is we're gypping people. I think people are fed by that stuff. And if you don't utilize that, why, I think you're gypping your people. You're shortchanging them. So, let us turn to the three burdens of meaning in the sign. When I say the sign, I'm talking about things like architectural setting. All of these could be considered signs, that is, ways of speaking, including nonverbal ways of speaking, communicating, expressing. And there are three ways to understand. lantern or pulpit, candles at the seat of the presider. All of those are quite appropriate, simply so that if there's a power failure, again, primary experience, boy, it happens sometimes, the presiders and the leaders have a book and can read by the light of the candle. And you've been at a candlelight service, I'm sure, where there's been nothing but candlelight, and it's wonderful. But that's a utilitarian purpose for candles. Before we even can talk about the symbolic meaning of candles as the light of the world and symbolizing Christ and so on, which you could talk about, I mean, you could draw all that out. Nevertheless, there is a utilitarian purpose that we ought to honor. And I think we ought to have candles at our altar, for instance, that allow the pastor and the worship leaders to read the book when they're at the altar, in case there's a power failure. There probably should be candles at the lectern for the same reason. Back in the old days, the pastor and the worship leaders were the only literate ones. And I'm going to make that case again tomorrow, that worship ought to be post-literate, or pre-literate, or post-Gutenberg, or pre-Gutenberg, or whatever. Lutherans particularly, but Protestants generally, are very, very impressed with texts, printed texts. And they want to have their nose pressed in a book all the time. But that's not worship. Good worship is you put the book down and you give your attention to what's going on. As I said yesterday, worship is something people do together. And the words interpret it and make commentary on it and embellish it and so on. But worship is something that people do, and we ought to give ourselves to that experience and not have our nose always in a text. That's very first world, among other things. It's not third world, it's first world. It's very middle class. It has to do with literacy and being able to read. A lot of people can't. Little kids, surely. A lot of adults are illiterate, functionally illiterate. We ought to make the most of that and rejoice in that and design our worship that includes them and does not exclude them. Talk about inclusive worship. Boy, oh boy. A lot of our churches, we push a Bible into people's hands. We push a book of worship in their hands. We push a guide to worship, a bulletin in their hand. We push a celebrate in their hand. What are we telling them when we do that? We're telling them, this is going to be difficult. And further, you're not going to like it very much. Furthermore, I don't like it very much, but we're stuck with it, so let's all turn to page 77. I mean, oh, what a terrible attitude. But isn't that the way it is in a lot of churches? You know, all this text people have to juggle. Worship should be so part of your, you know, I say the Lord be with you, what do you say? Terrific. That's all you need to know. I say a prayer and I pray, Lord, in your mercy, and you say? Yeah. Terrific. I mean, that's all you need. You don't need a book for that. Most of our worship is much too Gutenberg, much too print-oriented. You want to interrupt? Go ahead.
I was raised in the Lutheran tradition and love all of this stuff. And you know, I want the church to be draped in everything and darkened on Good Friday. And you know, I love all those vigils and everything. But people who weren't raised in that tradition find it pretty high church and kind of off-putting and not Protestant.
Right.
What about that?
Yeah, we have work to do, don't we? To assimilate those people in a gracious way into our way of doing things. I think our way of doing things in the long run feeds you in a way that typical Protestant worship does not. What's that?
They're always flipping through the book and they can't find
anything.
Yeah,
terrible, terrible.
Yeah. If I go to a Methodist church, it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah, yeah. We should not require that of people. Again, our experience of worship should be this primary kind of thing where you don't need the book. You should put a person who's new alongside somebody who knows all the traditions and who's willing to initiate that person into it. We ought to have classes in that kind of thing. We ought to be preaching about it. We ought to have bulletin announcements printed in text, I suppose, about it. You know, we've got an educational job, but I don't think we should back away from that educational job or give up on it and make our worship more like whatever. Because I think we've got a gift here that the rest of the world needs, even though the rest of the world doesn't know it. Let me give you an example.
There's none of it in the Sunday school curriculum.
Say it again?
I teach Sunday school too, and there's none of it in the Sunday
school. Yeah, it should be in our Sunday school curriculum.
Actually. I shook them up through the church and showed them all the symbols and stuff, and the kids were just, you know.
Oh, they love it, sure. Kids understand that stuff very easily.
Better.
Yeah.
Makes it more fun.
But we beat it out of our kids somehow, and they're growing up, and it's a pity. Let me give you an example. Almost any example that draws an analogy from what happens at worship to what happens at home is probably a good analogy. Let me give an example from home. If you come to my house for a dinner, I'm going to sit you down at the dining room table with the rest of my family, and I'm going to give you a cloth napkin and a napkin ring. Now, I've discovered that a lot of families don't have napkins, much less napkin rings. I mean, it's scandalous to me that they don't, but a lot of people don't, apparently, and live quite happy lives without it. But I want to show people how to use a napkin and a napkin ring. And is that fuss budgety of me, or anal retentive, or North European, or whatever? I don't think it is. I think it's just one way of having a nice meal. Now, out here at the barbecue, you can have a paper napkin and you throw it away. But my point is, a person who does not use a napkin and a napkin ring has to be initiated into its use. And if you're a guest in that kind of a house, you have to be willing to say, hey, what are these people around me doing, and can I do what they're doing, and, you know, can I fit in somehow? You have to ask yourself that. Am I going to stand when they stand, and sit when they sit, and kneel when they kneel, and so on? You see what I mean? As a guest, in other words, you've got some work to do. But as a host, you have some work to do, too. If you're the host, you have to help these people appropriate this and make it accessible to them. And my feeling is that it can be accessible to them. Let's talk about prayer for a minute. When you were a kid, you were taught, I was taught, you kneeled down for prayer, you folded your hands, and you bowed your head. And a lot of churches do this, you know, at the confession at the beginning of the service and so on. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good posture for prayer. You should know, however, that it's not Jewish or Christian, really. It came into Jewish practice and Christian practice in about the 4th century A.D., after Christ. And it came from the battlefield. You kneel before your conqueror, and you put out your hands for the chains of slavery, and you bow your head for the sword, and understandably, perhaps, close your eyes. I mean, that is a super humble position, right? Can you think of anything that's more humble? Prone, yeah, prostrate. And if you've ever seen a Roman Catholic ordination, the priests at a Roman Catholic ordination are prostrate on the floor. Like that. Now, you could argue that prostrate is a good way to pray. You could argue that kneeling is a good way to pray. I think I kneel in Advent and Lent. But the Jewish way of prayer was this. Standing up, hands raised, palms up, waiting to receive the blessings that God is showering upon you. And head up and eyes open. Eyes open. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, that is a picture. It's a picture of two things. It's a picture of us being made in the image of God, not groveling. I mean, this is, I think this kind of a posture is a relatively groveling type of posture that is not compatible with Jewish piety or Christian piety. We are made in the image of God, says the Jews, and say Christians, so we should stand for prayer. Not kneel for prayer, stand for prayer. Especially during the Easter season, stand for prayer. Stand for the reception of the Holy Communion. Don't kneel, stand. And the leaders of prayer pray with their hands up, and their heads up, and their eyes open. Now, that's one picture. It's a picture of being made in the image of God. Who knows, the German, or for that matter, one of the Scandinavian languages, for resurrection. Auferstehung is German, and it's Obstanden in Danish, am I right? And what is it translated literally into English? The standing up of Christ. Christ in the resurrection stands up. He's not prone, he's not lying down lifeless. He's full of life again, he's standing up. So the erect and standing posture for prayer is a posture that proclaims the resurrection life. Isn't that neat? I think that's great. We should be conscious of that, and I don't kneel anymore. Well, maybe in Advent and Lent, I kneel for the confession. But I think the posture of standing, and standing with hands up and eyes open, that's a wonderful picture of being made in the image of God and the resurrection. It might mean that you have to have a helper to hold your book for you if you're going to stand like this. I should point that out. But again, would you mind standing up here? You hold my book as an acolyte, and I'm praying. Isn't that a nice picture? Now, he is modeling Christ here. In this situation, he's Christ for me because he's serving me, right? Now, in another situation, I might be holding the book for him. You can stand with your hands up. Beautiful. Now, thank you very much. Now, that's a picture, you see, of one waiting upon the other and serving the other. And I think it's a terrific model that you're giving to the congregation. When you have an acolyte or an assisting minister who holds your book, and then on other occasions you hold the book for that person, you know, that is a terrific picture of people serving each other and being Christ to each other. And again, people pick up on that. It doesn't matter to God, you could read sitting down. You could hold your own book. Please, Mother, I'd rather do it myself. Remember those TV commercials a couple years ago? Please, Mother, I'd rather do it myself. Sure, I can hold my own book. But it's so much nicer to have a living lectern. Okay, so there's a utilitarian meaning to most of this. There is a symbolical or pedagogical meaning. And there's even a historic meaning. Vestments, let's take the vestments. Utilitarian purpose or meaning of vestments, they cover up the rubber tire waistline, the looming buns, the gaudy necktie, the shiny knees, the patch on the fanny, whatever. What it does is it serves to direct the attention of the worshipers away from the idiosyncrasies of the leaders to the event itself. Now, that's the utilitarian purpose for vestments, and it could be a black robe, it could be a bathrobe, it could be your pajamas, doesn't matter, but you have to explain it to people, right? And if you're going to explain it to people, then it better not be bathrobe. I mean, I don't think there's much symbolism there. You may as well use the historic vestments, in my view. If you're going to have vestments at all, they may as well be the historic vestments. So, utilitarian purpose, covering up the buns, the fanny, shiny trousers, the gaudy necktie, whatever. The symbolic purpose, that white alb that is becoming, you should know this, it's becoming an ecumenical vestment. That white alb, I know Mennonites who wear the white alb in worship leadership. The white alb is becoming an ecumenical vestment, much more so than the black robe. Black robe used to be very popular among Protestants. A lot of them are abandoning that now and picking up the white robe, the alb, because it is the garment of baptism. You may know ancient baptisms were nude, naked, by immersion. You took off all the clothes, everything that pertained to the old life, earrings, jewelry, clothes, descended naked into the font, came up on the other side and put on a white robe, clothed in the righteousness of Christ. Again, a neat picture. And again, not lost certainly on kids and on adults too who have been taught. So the white robe is a picture, a reminder of your baptism. That's the pedagogical or the symbolic purpose. And then the historic purpose for vestments. I have a pastor friend of mine who says, every time I put on these vestments, I am 2,000 years old. That's nice to think of too. Martin Luther would recognize the alb and stolen chasuble. St. Augustine would recognize the alb and stolen chasuble. St. Ambrose, and, you know, I mean, way back to the earliest church, I suppose Moses would recognize some version of it. So there's a value in that historic continuity, I think, that ties us in with our grandparents and their grandparents and their grandparents. So, three burdens of meaning: utilitarian, symbolic, and historical. Finally, a word about right and wrong, and then we'll open the floor to discussion. I think it's a mistake to talk about right and wrong in worship. This is right and this is wrong. Better, I think, would be to say this is true to the ecumenical consensus that has been developing, or it's contrary to the ecumenical consensus that's been developing. And our Lutheran Book of Worship, again, represents, in my view, and in the view of many, our Lutheran version of that ecumenical consensus. We don't have to be ashamed of this book. This stands squarely in that baptism, Eucharist, and ministry tradition, the tradition of an ecumenical consensus, ecumenical agreement about what worship is all about. As I have said yesterday, Christian people asking the same questions and coming up with the same answers about what worship is, what worship means, how you use vestments, what about the colors of the seasons and all that stuff. So, rather than say, well, this practice is wrong and this practice is right, it might better say, this practice is true and faithful to the ecumenical consensus, and another practice is not so true or not so faithful to that ecumenical consensus. We want to honor, in other words, that consensus. I think we should be willing to honor it. And I think I would be willing, for instance, to utilize even such a thing as the designations in this book. What do we call our chief service on Sunday morning in this book? What does it say at the top of the page? Huh? Say it out loud. Holy Communion. Yeah. Holy Communion is the title that we use. We don't have Eucharist. We have Holy Communion. Now, some churches call their service Eucharist, and there's nothing wrong with Eucharist. It's a good word. Eucharist is Greek. It means thanksgiving. It's from a Greek word that means thanksgiving, and it suggests what human beings do, namely give thanks to God. And it's a perfectly fine word, but I prefer what our book calls it, namely Holy Communion. Eucharist is one directional. It goes from me to God, from you to God. But communion is me and you and God, and me and God. You see what I mean? I like the term better anyhow. Holy Communion suggests all these directions, whereas Eucharist is just one directional. But it's a good word. A lot of churches call it. You could call it the Mass, I suppose. You could call it the liturgy. That's what the Greeks call it. The Greek and Russian Orthodox call it simply the liturgy. We call it the Holy Communion. And it's kind of nice, I think, to use those terms. I like what I have discovered in the introduction to this book, and I will then shut up. Page 8. You didn't know about this introduction, but you should read it someday. Having considered their resources and their customs, congregations will find their own balance between fully using the ritual and musical possibilities of the liturgy and a more modest practice. See what that's doing? It's giving you permission to experiment a little bit and to play around a little bit. Don't have to be stuck with this book. Then it goes on, a full service should not allow secondary ceremonies to eclipse central elements of the liturgy, nor should a simple service omit essential or important parts. That's a good standard, I think. And we'll talk about some of that tomorrow. Okay, let's talk. Don't be shy. Go ahead.
Which particular thing would you like me to get first?
Which particular what?
Aspect.
Oh.
I'm bothered particularly by your rejection of modern technology.
Hmm.
Because that is essentially what I see. And this is one of the things that the church is struggling with. I can think of many, many reasons why we should use the modern technology. But just as with these, those are aids to worship. And one of the reasons that many of the non-liturgical churches find difficulty with those is because they have become ends in themselves. Just as you say, the utilitarian purpose of the vestment, or even its symbolic meaning, sometimes is overcome by the fact that it gets to be so overdone. The vestment is, you know, practically a walking flower garden or something like that. It has forgotten what it was there for, the architecture and so on. Our church sports a fake Gothic arch, and how many don't, you know. But as in a book that I once read on the small church, I have that book, how to build and furnish it, and the author just, oh, this ugly scissors arch, or excuse me, truss. Oh. You just don't use that.
A-frame, well, yeah.
A very nice way of, inside that, of keeping the walls from bulging and the roof from sagging, but it wasn't Gothic, and so therefore it wasn't Christian.
Yeah, every church had to look like a Gothic church back in those days, yeah.
You know, the whole thing, why do we have to do it simply because somebody else is doing it? Why do a lot of churches insist on using the word Eucharist? Because it's the new thing.
Yeah.
They don't understand that it puts the emphasis on what we're doing to God, for God, really, rather than what God is doing for us in the communion. So I think the whole thing, but I still, on the other hand, as the very, you know, probably in the field of music, there's probably no more traditional area than the strings, the violin, you know, this goes back so long. And yet the old fellow who taught me violin repair said, I think it's stupid, maybe even sinful, not to use modern technology. He used epoxy glue where it should be used. On the other hand, we still use the old gelatin, you know, kind of a form of jello for gluing other parts together. But I think that says something. We need to use the technology where it can be, rather than jumping on the bandwagon simply because everybody else does. How many people can hear much better, even in a smaller place, because of the...
Because of the microphone, sure. Your warning is well taken, and I want to affirm technology and celebrate it and give it its proper due. You're talking to a man who has a hearing aid in both ears, as a matter of fact, and who has, furthermore, an artificial valve in his chest. I had open heart surgery 20 years ago, and I have a little nylon ping pong ball in a metal cage in my chest, in my aortic valve position. My old valve cut out, no good, and thrown away, and a new one put in. So I have great respect for technology. On the other hand, it has its limits. And I would like to see a church that brings you as much as possible, as directly as possible, in contact with these primary experiences. And if you can do away without that microphone, try it.
But then we really should get away from some of the canned forms of liturgy. I mean, let's get really primary. Mm. Let's get in there without some of this even plan. You know, and you're talking about, okay, let's not use written materials. Mm-hmm. Okay, then that's going to bring us back to, for instance, with the old black worship services, the solo.
Lining out
chorus,
the hymns and so on. I'd love to see that happen,
response.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh God, or how about ages past? Oh,
let's do that without somebody knowing ahead of time what they're going to do then. I mean, then you're getting primary.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to see that tried. The hymn book has a place, and texts and books have a place, but I'm overstating my case for pedagogical reasons. But I take your criticism to heart, and sure, there's a place for technology. But what I'm maintaining is we're just so in love with it that we forget about the fact that there are limits to it, limits to its usefulness.
What are we doing wrong in terms of getting the basic teenager, we knock it out of them as children, by the time they're teens, if they come to church, if they're brought with their parents, if they come, they sit there like stones and virtually hate what they're going through. They do not see this stuff. Is that a matter of teaching, a matter of...
Teenagers are a special case. They hate a lot of things. I mean, you go through a stage, don't you, where you reject everything that your parents stand for and everything that the church stood for and so on. And that's, you know, to be expected perhaps of teenagers, and you hope that they'll grow out of it. Kids below the teenage level are a different story, and I heard somebody say, these are my words now, not the speaker's, but children are the miner's canary of worship. You know what a miner's canary is? Or was, they would take a canary down in a cage, down in the mine, and when the canary died, that was a sign that the air was too bad and they better get out. The human beings had better get out. So the point is that if children are bored with our worship, something is wrong with our worship. Kids should not be bored. How will I say this in a polite way? Maybe I can't. Let me just say it. Last night's Vespers, for instance, was led by a Quaker and a lovely, pious woman. I have no, you know, her relationship with her God and with us and so on is splendid. But it represented, phenomenologically, if you want to look at it that way, 20 minutes of an adult standing at a microphone speaking to us. Now, a lot of the kids found that boring or difficult to handle and fell asleep and so on. I think that ought to teach us, that kind of experience ought to teach us, if we want to include children, and again, I would be willing to bend over backwards to include them, kata holon, pertaining to the whole. That's what the word Catholic means. Catholic worship is worship that pertains to the whole of the human family, including little kids, including people who can't read, including people who are blind, including people who are handicapped in one way or another, or challenged in one way or another. That's the whole of the human race. That's the whole of God's creation. Our worship ought to include and embrace all of that. And if it doesn't, we're in trouble. So I would want to design worship normally. And there's a place, may I say, there's a place for that kind of adult. I would regard it as a rather adult type of thing. But we ought to take a clue from that. Why do parents love the children's sermon so much in church? You know, it's short, it's got one point, and it's very visual usually. Now, preachers ought to take advantage of that and preach sermons that are short and have one point and are full of life and vigor. Go ahead. Oh. So children are the miner's canary. If children are bored or restless, then we got some work to do to make our worship include them.
I've done children's sermonettes before, and our lay assistant at our congregation would ask me to fill in for him when he was to be gone, younger, about the same age as I am. And we would get into discussions, and his name was Paul, and I'd say, Paul, you know, when I get up there and I'm talking to those kids, I don't know if I'm talking to these kids right here in front of me. Are those kids out there?
Exactly, yeah.
And it's a real, you know, what you're saying to them is just, it's kind of just going right back.
Absolutely.
There
and they're listening.
It's scary. It's really scary sometimes.
And now, you don't want to misuse the children, you know.
No.
To get at the parents, but that's a good point. Children ought to teach us something.
One thought that occurs to me, kind of pertains to architecture, but I wonder if it kind of ties in with some of the making this meaningful to our age, our present time. I remember a lecture given by a college professor where I was going to school about worship and about the church and architecture, and he mentioned that in the for centuries, the tall, and still in Europe, it's still sort of the tallest point in any town was the cross on the top of the steeple. What is the tallest buildings in our cities today?
The banks.
Insurance companies and banks. And what does that say about where our whole culture has both changed?
Where our values are.
The values are, right. So it shouldn't come as any surprise that this is a very difficult thing to try to present to our culture and our age, even to present to fellow Christians, because we are a product of this age.
Definitely. May I say that in the days when the church was the biggest building in town, you know, I'm not personally willing to go back to those days.
Yeah.
You know, that was a triumphalism. You know, Notre Dame Cathedral and all those churches, they're gorgeous pieces of architecture, but boy, oh boy, I'm not so sure about the theology there.
If we embrace all of these ideas, there are certainly other things that would enrich the service that are used by other traditions that aren't used saints.
Dance, wasn't the dance wonderful? Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Saints, dance, insects.